Production. Recorded live.
Well, good evening, every all. Welcome to Unzipping Reality, the Third Awakening. I'm Leah LaChapelle, sitting here at the helm for this voyage this evening. Today is July the 20th, 2014, and we're right here in the middle of the summer in Austin, Texas, where I live, and we're just absolutely finding new points of joy. We're cracking open new realms for literal happiness. Yeah, that's what we do here in the Third Awakening. If you want to stay back in the doldrums, in the dull places, and you kind of like whining and complaining and suffering, then you might want to tune into a different program, because here on Unzipping Reality, we are awake, we are aware, and we are launching into new realms that really heretofore we have never dreamed of. And so before I bring up my fascinating guest tonight, David Browning, let's just go ahead and acclimate to this marvelous energy. It's a very powerful energy. I want everyone to get comfortable. I give you my best greeting, us love us. That's New Paradigm Speak for Namaste. And so just get comfortable, because you're going to want to tune in with all of your attention tonight to David Browning, who will be bringing us the Mystic Seven. And so do I have your attention? Great. Thank you so much for tuning in by way of live broadcast and also archive. We love our archive listeners as well. So, reality is actually sufficiently unzipped so that we can see the portal. We know there's a portal there. It's waiting for us. It's open. Who did that? We did that. So, my invitation is for us to step on through and be who and what we really are. Now, joining me this evening is my wonderful friend, David Browning, and he is going to be introducing us to some new thought constructs. But beyond that, this is an experience. This is about our lives. And he's going to really plunge us into a new space. So a little bit about David Browning. You know, David was just living his life about 17 years ago when something happened to him. Something happened for him. Something happened in him. And he came in contact with a new beingness, his soul. And I'm going to let David explain a little bit more about his experience, because he can do it far better than I. But he's done many things in his life. He's been a part of a healing arts center in Phoenix, Arizona for 12 years, where he gained much knowledge and techniques and states of consciousness, etc. But it gets better than that. In 2010, he traveled to India. Now, I mean, that's kind of the prescriptive, right? We go to India, and amazing things happen in India, and certainly did for David, where he met some very holy presences in India. And I'm going to let him explain to you the gifts that those beings were to him. When he returned from India, he published his first book entitled Seeing Through the Eyes of God, and also developed his course, The Mystic Seven, Seven Keys to Abiding in the Awareness of the Enlightened Mind. David has dedicated his life to helping others to silence their mind, enter into a state of consciousness that he now is joyously abiding in at all times. He's going to be in Austin, Texas, where I live, on August the 2nd, and he'll be presenting his Mystic 7 course that is not an intellectual pursuit in any way. It's not a lecture. It is an experience, and he'll be unpacking that for us this evening. So join us tonight in experiencing the inexpressible. We'll do our best to express the Mystic 7 as known by David Browning. Welcome to Unzipping Reality, David. It's such a beautiful pleasure to have you.
Good evening, Leah.
Wonderful.
How are you doing?
Yes. And we're connected, right?
Yes. We are.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Well, all right. So here we are. We are connecting on the highest plane that I know of that is available to us. And I'd like to ask you, first and foremost, in light of the title of your offering called The Mystic Seven, can you tell us, what is a mystic? What do you think a mystic is? How do you experience a mystic, and I guess you are one, right?
That's some people have called me that, yes.
And so what is it? What is a mystic?
I would have to define that as someone who is continually aware and abides in a state of their true nature. Someone who, everywhere they look, everything they see as God.
Mm. Okay, let me get this clear. Everything?
Everything.
Everything. Okay, I think we're getting the vibration now. Thank you very much. So, as we had discussed earlier before the broadcast, you are actually, I didn't say this in the opening remarks, but you are actually the founder and facilitator for the Samadhi Retreat and Meditation Center. That is in Texas between Palestine and Athens, for those of us who want to know, Texas. And so in the title of this beautiful place, and we're going to talk about that later, you named it Samadhi. You named your beautiful, loving space, this incredible retreat and meditation center, you named it Samadhi. Can you tell us what that word is? It doesn't sound like English to me. And so why did you choose that word? What is Samadhi? Can you just kind of unfold that for us a little bit?
Absolutely. As you mentioned, 17 years ago, I had an experience. And what happened was I was on a flight back from Washington, D.C., and I went into a state. At the time, I didn't know what it was. It was just this pure silence. And when I got home that evening, I went to the couch and I sat down at 10 o'clock. I knew nothing of Eastern religion, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sufism, any of those paths at all. And when I sat on the couch, I went into a state of what I call nothingness. There was no sound, no voices. I wasn't channeling. I saw no visions. There was just this pure emptiness. 6 hours later, at 4 o'clock in the morning, I came out. And the very first thing that I was aware of, that I was eternal, that I would never die. And it was not a cognitive process. It wasn't something I thought, oh, this is what I saw or what I felt. It was a knowing that was inside of me. And I remember looking at the door and wishing that someone would come through the door with a sword and cut my head off at that moment, because I knew that I would be somewhere else observing that action, that I would still exist, that I was truly eternal. The next night at 10 o'clock, I didn't think, oh, that was a neat experience and I'll go back and try that again. I simply sat at the couch at 10 o'clock, disappeared into this nothingness, into this emptiness again. And when I came out at around 4 o'clock that morning, 6 hours later, I had a similar experience. When I came out, there was this awareness that I was infinite. This process continued for about 6 months. And later, years and years and years later, I realized that what was happening was that I was going into the source, that I was going to a place which was within all of us. And this silence, this nothingness that abides there, is where all knowledge of the universe exists, where every experience, where every emotion, where every thought, where every life that has ever existed and ever will abides. And in that moment that you abide in that space, you bring back everything with you. And I use the word samadhi because it's the closest word I've been able to find that describes, that is close to the description of the spirit experience.
All right, so I can read minds, and I know that people are wanting to know, what were you smoking?
Absolutely nothing. Matter of fact, as a young teenager, I did experiment with different, you know, drinking and smoking a little pot and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I had started a documentary film company 12 years prior to this experience and had gotten into a point of my life where that kind of activity was no longer of interest to me. I didn't drink at all. I mean, not even a drink, a drop of wine, a single beer. I did not smoke cigarettes. I did absolutely nothing whatsoever. This was a completely natural occurrence.
You're not the first person that I've heard say this. What is it that happens when a human, a physicality, emotional being, no longer craves that kind of a substance? Because, you know, word has it on the street that that stuff is pretty fun, that it's pleasurable, yada, yada. I mean, do you are you disallowing certain pleasures in your life? Or what happens? Why did you stop craving that?
Well, most of that came just from when I started my company, my documentary film company. I was living a life where I was totally fulfilled. I was traveling around the world. I had all the money that I ever needed. I had a wife and a family who loved me. I got to do things that people only dreamed of doing, climbing mountains in northern Italy, treasure hunting in the Caribbean, traveling through South America. It was just, I was so fulfilled that there was no need for that at all. And on the aircraft, when I was flying back from D.C., that was the only awareness I had, was that at that point in my life, I could not attain anything else. Sure, I could have a little bit more money. I might be able to go to one more spot on the planet that I hadn't been to, even though I'd traveled around the world at least 4 times. And I knew that there was nothing to attain. And in that moment of pure fulfillment was when I dropped into that silence.
Did it feel like a relief?
I don't know if it was a release. It was just, I knew my life was over, that the life that I was existing was over, that I was now going to go to a place that was just pure truth, just pure knowledge.
Mm. So in this place of silence, deep, deep within, this is samadhi?
Yes. Samadhi is the pure and absolute silence of the mind. That is my definition.
All right. Of the mind.
Yes.
Is this the the mind of a human, one human being's mind, or are you referring to the universal mind?
It would be on a conventional level, and I'd like to discuss a little bit later about the difference between conventional and ultimate reality. On a conventional level, it would be the human mind. We have so much activity all the time. I have to be at work at 8 o'clock. I have to worry about my children in 6th grade and 10th grade, how they're doing with their grades. I have to worry about my spouse and my place in society. And so the mind is continually active. It never rests. It's just spinning and spinning and spinning. So in samadhi, that mind, that ego, it completely drops into silence. But as I mentioned, when the conventional ego mind becomes silent, you drop into the consciousness of the source where everything abides.
All right. So it becomes very still and quiet. Do you still have to drive your carpool? Do you still go to work? Do you still make dinner?
Once you become, well, yes, absolutely. I remember the very first experience I had of this. I was actually driving a car, and when I came out of samadhi after about an hour, I was still driving the car, still on the highway 175 coming into Dallas. But I hadn't been aware of that. Basically, the source had taken over, and it was in control of all of that, and I came out. Once you start practicing samadhi, practicing being able to go in that state, there's actually three different states of samadhi. The first state is the one that I abided in during those 6 hours, which I call Asama Prajnata Samadhi. And that's a samadhi where there's absolutely no perception at all. The eyes are closed, there's no vision, there's no sound, there's absolutely nothing, not even an awareness of an experience, and therefore there is no experiencer. There is nothing.
Okay.
The other two samadhis, the first one I call is actually a term in Sanskrit, which is called Samprajnata Samadhi, and that is samadhi where there is perception, where your eyes are open and you perceive everything around you, but you perceive it simply as the source. You see it as God. So there is no attachment, there is no anger, there is no sorrow, there is no suffering. There is just the divine. But there is no experience with it. It is just the perception of things around you as God. Then the third is actually a name that I had to make up because there wasn't anyone that I could find anywhere in any texts or scriptures. And it was called, I call it Samprajnata Ananda Samadhi. And that is samadhi where there is perception, where you are in a waking state and you see everything around you as God. But there is an accompanying experience of bliss where there is just this unbelievable energy of bliss that you are abiding in. And so in these three states, they are somewhat different in what you experience.
Well, it certainly sounds like it. And so how did people respond to you initially when you went into samadhi? Did they think you were in a coma?
Well, fortunately, it happened just at night. For the first 6 months during this process, it was occurring between 10 o'clock in the evening and 4 o'clock in the morning. So the only one that really knew anything was happening was my wife, because I wasn't coming to bed to be with her. And I talked to her and told her the process I was going through. And every day after I came out, I would spend several hours journaling. I would write in this state of awareness, in this samadhi state. I would go to the computer and I would just journal. And it wasn't of my mind. It wasn't, oh, this is what the experience was and this is what it was like. It was just pure information that we all are aware of that's within us. And when she would wake up, I would express to her what happened, you know, what experience I had, the stuff that I had written. And I would travel, I was at Canyon Lake at the time, and I would visit this one lady and share with her what was going on. But from her perspective, all it was some guy, you know, and I don't really know. She may have thought I was completely crazy or that I was awakening. I really don't know. But she was very kind and would let me share this with her. So there wasn't a lot of people around me that were seeing me anymore. At this point, I had left both of my jobs. I had a documentary film company that I owned, and I also had a patent, a U.S. patent that was in Walmart, Cabela's Bass Pro Shop. So I had two very successful companies that I had basically just walked away from. I had decided that this is what I wanted to do, that I wanted to know the truth at any cost, no matter what it took. So I was mainly alone for those 6 months.
So the jobs were not as interesting to you as a motivation as they once were. You were more motivated by your journey in truth.
Absolutely.
I see. Absolutely. I see. So these states of samadhi, what happens to your personality? Do you have a personality?
Yes, I do. I assume people talk to me and people interact with me in a certain way. It has changed quite a bit because I own nothing. I desire nothing. I don't go shopping and I don't need money to go out and get things. The 2 years that I spent in India, I had two pairs of pants, two shirts, a bowl, and I lived in a monastery with monks and had absolutely no possessions, which is how I live my life now. But I still interact with people. I still carry some of my habits, and I'm somewhat a little OCD, so I still have that tendency. But as far as an existence of David Browning, that no longer exists.
I see. But you remember him well, obviously.
Yes, I do.
And so now, as you live your life, you're still in a physical plane. You remember the prior David Browning. What is ahead for you?
Well, I'd like to mention one thing that you brought up right there, and that was that I am still in a physical body.
Mm-hmm.
The Mystic Seven, and I guess first of all, I'd like to just mention this. After the 6 months, what I did was I went out for about 2 years, and I wanted to find out if I had lost my mind, if I was crazy, or if this was an experience that people had. So I started looking for anything I could get my hands on, a book, literature, courses, techniques, practices. And I found a lot of things that I found were very superficial. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but they weren't reaching the depths of the awareness that I had experienced. And then I found some texts and some practices that were discussing these. They're very obscure texts. One of them is called the Yoga Vasistha. Another one is called the Upadesa Sahasri. And these are ancient Sanskrit texts that most people aren't familiar of. But within them, not only did I find descriptions of the experience I had, but they were word for word what I had written in my journals. Knowledge that is thousands of years old in this state of consciousness, and infinite because it has existed forever. And the Mystic Seven is basically seven experiences. These are direct experiences that are common throughout any person during their process of awakening. Everybody will have different sorts of flavors, like some people will have psychic experiences, or some people will go into shamanism, and some people will get energy from crystals, and so they'll have these different flavors, but all of them, without exception, have these same seven experiences, and that is, there is a source. You are eternal. You are infinite. You are one. There is no separation of you or anything that surrounds you. there is a state called nothingness, which you abide in. And when you return from that nothingness, which is actually beyond enlightenment, you come back with this awareness of neither affirmation nor negation, and the awareness that there is no essential nature. Because you are the source, because you are everything, then you have no essential nature because you are everything. And that's the Mystic Seven. But before that, I was still struggling with, there's no way you can teach this. This is experiential. And so I just went to a cave. I decided, because this couldn't be shared, because it's inexpressible, because it has to be experienced, I just went to a cave, my own self-imposed cave, which was a healing arts center for 12 years and then India for 2 years. But in India, at the end of a year and a half of silence, I met a monk, and he gave me this concept, which is called conventional and ultimate awareness. And in that, I realized that I would be able to give people tools that they could use to have this experience. And I could give them guides to help them remind themselves, are they in conventional awareness or are they in ultimate awareness?
Is there any other kind of awareness below conventional awareness? I mean, is it like zombie awareness?
Well,
I mean, you know,
not
some
really.
People have no idea whatsoever that they are even conscious.
Right.
That that's even possible. So there are people walking around the planet that are quite unconscious, and then there are people who are probably conventionally conscious. But I love your terminology, the conventional versus the ultimate, because this has a whole languaging around it. But before we get further into that, I want to go back to the nothingness, because I have heard this term before. I think I read about this in The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, and he calls it the no thing. It's more like a hyphenated word. It's like the no thingness. The no thing, nothing. You're saying it like it's nothingness, like there's no thing and there never was and there never will be.
Right, and that's the misunderstanding that a lot of people have, that nothingness is nothing. And what happens is when you first go into the experience of nothingness, and again, I'd like to remind you that, and everybody listening, that when you are on an awakened state and you reach the state of enlightenment, you have perceived that you are eternal. You have perceived that you are infinite, that you are one with everything, and that there is this source. And what happens is everything around you is God. Everything around you is the divine. And you're in this state of extreme bliss. But you still are aware that there is something beyond that, something beyond enlightenment. And when you drop into nothingness for an extended period of time, you realize that that's where you had always been before, in this emptiness, into this void. But it's not nothing, because within this state of nothingness abides everything. Every sound, every smell, every emotion, every experience, every life, everything. Everything, every animal, every person, every planet, every existence, through all time and space, exists within this nothingness. But because it's so vast, because it's so big, the individual mind can't comprehend it. So when you're abiding in this state, there is no experience at all.
Got it. It's pure attention.
Yes.
Yes, and have you found that human beings have an intrinsic fear of being nothing, like they're going to be annihilated and no longer exist?
Yes, absolutely we do. And it's the ego. The ego is, it knows that if you go and even peek at this, that there's a chance that it will die. And so it does everything in its power to not let you see this. And when we glimpse into it, it happened to me when I was a teenager. I was actually doing some course in light in Dallas. And we did the white light, we did the green light, we did the blue light, and all of a sudden the instructor took us to the gold light. And the moment I saw that gold light, I went, uh-oh, there's the truth. And I ran out of that room in pure terror because I knew the moment I went into that light, I would die. That I, as this ego, as this individual self, would no longer exist, even though I would merge and become the source, all-powerful, all-knowing. There was still that the ego does not want that. The ego does not want to die.
For sure. I want to remind everyone that this is a live call, and if you have a question for David Browning, don't be bashful. You can call in 724-444-7444. The ID number is 128838. 128838. And then press 1 if you want to speak with David, and I'll recognize you on the call. And if there's something else that is not working, just go ahead and start talking and we'll hear you. Sometimes that works because the technology is what it is. So, David, you know, your main nomenclature is Samadhi and Mystic 7. Why 7? Is 7 some sort of a numerological number that was given to you? Did you just have a knowingness about it? Was it just dumb luck that you just happened to think up 7 steps to Samadhi, whatever? I mean, tell us, what is the 7 all about?
Well, really it was just dumb luck. I mean, if anything else. I learned in the very beginning that I could not control any of this process. Probably the third night that I was sitting on the couch, I was getting kind of cocky and I thought, wow, you know, tonight what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and visit some parallel universe or go to the astral plane and meet some master.
Right.
And when I sat down on the couch, my mind was going and it was all active and it was thinking about all these things that I was going to do. And I go, okay, I'm going in Samadhi, I'm going in Samadhi, I'm going in Samadhi, and absolutely nothing happened. And this happened for about 15 minutes, and finally I said, well, the heck with this. This isn't working. And the moment I released, I dropped into Samadhi. And I don't know if this was a knowing inside me or I was just, as I mentioned, I was going to do whatever it took. But I learned never, ever to try and control this. So with the Mystic 7, basically what I did was, after about the 2-year process of going out and finding that I hadn't lost my mind, that if I had, at least I was in good company with other mystics and enlightened masters that had walked the earth before, I started having to find ways to become established in this. Because whereas I was abiding in Samadhi maybe 4 to 6 hours a day at this point, I wasn't abiding in that state all the time. If somebody pulled me in front of me in traffic in downtown Dallas, I would get angry. If something happened financially, I would feel stressed and a sense of lack. And so what I did was I started looking at those emotions and those thoughts and those feelings. And what I found was that every single time that I was upset about anything, it had to do with one of these 7 things. And I didn't know it at the time. But if someone pulled in front of me in traffic and made me angry, what I did was I looked at that and I said, why am I angry? Why am I upset? And what I thought was, the instant thought was, I have separated from this person. I believe that the person in front of me is separate from myself. And the reason I'm angry is not because he pulled me over. I'm angry because I'm hurting inside because I'm living in a state of delusion where I believe I'm separate from myself.
Yes.
So every time this would happen, I would go, okay, what is causing this emotion? What is causing this anger? What is causing this pain within me? And it would always be these 7 things. I had seen myself as finite, that I had seen myself as a little bitty person named David Browning, when in fact I was everything in the universe. I am everyone that is driving every car. I am every animal. I am every plant. I am every star. I am every planet. And in that awareness that you are infinite, those little bitty things that you become attached to become insignificant. They don't even exist anymore. And so what happened after about, I think it was probably 12 years, when I finally became fully established in this every second of every day, I started looking at, okay, what is the process? What are the things that are helping me stay in this state of consciousness? And it ended up being about 9, I remember, at the time. I don't remember the exact number, but it was 9 or 10 of them. And I worked on it for about a year, and I actually found out that several of them were redundant. And it basically just got culled down to this Mystic 7.
I see. All right. So how are you now in 2014 when somebody pulls out, or I don't know, maybe you don't even drive, I don't know. But if something like that happens, let's just call it a big irritation.
Mm-hmm.
How is that for you now?
It does not affect me at all.
Because you no longer believe in separation.
That's correct.
And you did the work of getting to the source of your anger.
Yes.
And I'm hearing you say that the source of your anger was belief in separation.
Absolutely. All suffering in any state of consciousness arises from the belief that you are separate from the source. Once you become aware that you are God, there is nothing that can affect you. There is nothing that can hurt you.
So when you think of Source, do you capitalize Source? Is Source personal for you?
Yes. I don't know if personal is a good word, but I'll say yes. It is something that... It's not this ethereal thing outside there that I'm, you know, a concept or something. It is what I am. It is what we all are.
I see. That could be personal.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. I'm hearing that. And of course you get people arguing with that.
Yes, one of the things within metaphysics that I've recognized, and again, I wasn't raised a metaphysician in the strictest term. I did attend the First Church of Religious Science for a few years as a teenager.
Nice.
My father was a practicing metaphysician and a practitioner at the church. But I didn't know much about it other than people meditated, that my father told me that I could control my life, and if I didn't want to be sick, I didn't have to be. And so actually I never was in my life. So I did have some metaphysical practices. But as I started looking at this, what I realized was in the metaphysical community, they had a lot of terminology that negated what they knew within themselves and what they even said within their own practice. And one of them is... we are God. But then they would turn around and they would say, I am an extension of God, or I'm a child of God, or I'm the son of God. Well, you can only be one of the other. You can be either an extension of God or a manifestation of God or a child of God, or you can be God. You can't be both. You have to be one or the other. So in my perception, the way that I see everything within the universe and within ourselves is that we all are the source, period. This is what we are. And any time you say that you're an extension of something, you have created separation. And the problem and the reason we do that is because we've always been crucified for that. I mean, they hung Jesus on the cross for saying these things. And so we're very careful when we go around and try to express this innate wisdom and this knowledge within ourselves, because we don't want to be ostracized. We don't want to be exiled from the community. We don't want to be crucified. And so we make up these little terms that are safe for us out in the world. But the problem with that is then we start believing that term, that I am an extension of God, and we forget, no. I'm not an extension. I am God. I am the source.
It's protective mechanism.
Yes.
Yes. So it is fear-based, to to think yes. any other way.
Absolutely.
Well, I can assure you the listeners to Unzipping Reality are investigators. And at the very least, they will try this on. I think probably to find total agreement. So, all right. The Mystic Seven, you're going to be in Austin, Texas at Nature's Treasures, which if you've never been to Nature's Treasures, I invite you. It's 4103 North IH-35 on the northbound service road. You take the 38th and a half street exit and you're there. So you're going to be speaking on August the 2nd. That's a Saturday, and this is an all day, all morning and into the late afternoon, 9:30 to 5 event. It's not a lecture. It's an experience. And you're going to be developing this for us, with us, in terms of the Mystic Seven. And I am just very excited at the prospect of David Browning coming to Austin. It's going to be fantastic. And at this juncture, I also want to just give a humongous wet kiss to Dawn Breeze, because Dawn is a friend and a tremendous support to David. And I just love you, Dawn, and thank you so much for everything you're doing to support this effort so we can learn about the experience of ourselves as the mystic 1 through 7. So again, if you'd like to call in and speak with David, you may, or you can just chat online in our live community chat room and just type in your question, and I would be happy to relay that to David. So here we are. We have opened up the realm of samadhi. We have peeked into the Mystic Seven, and I am inviting everyone to learn as much as they can about the Mystic Seven. Let's go back to what you were talking about before, and this is what really lights me up. Is this idea about the conventional versus the ultimate? If you could give us some examples of that, if you've got that readily available, I'd love to hear the distinction between conventional and ultimate, because I need to clean up my lingo here.
Absolutely. We all do. As I mentioned, when I was in India, I met the monk, and when we would go on walks, one night I looked at him and I said, "You are Buddha." And he was horrified. He was, no, I'm not Buddha. That would be like going on a walk with a Christian and that you saying that you are God. They're like, no, I'm not God. And I said, but you practice every day. All of your teachings are that you are Buddha. And he said, no, I'm not Buddha. Buddha is this and this and this. And after about 30 minutes of talking, he went, "Oh, you mean I am Buddha?" And I went, "Yes, you are Buddha." And he said, "Well, you're talking in ultimate dialogue." And I said, "That's the only way I ever talk." And he said, "Well, nobody talks like that." Well, about the next evening, we went for another walk, and I said something along the lines about how he was infinite or something. And he was like, no, I'm not like that. And after about 30 minutes, he said, "Oh, you're talking in ultimate dialogue." And I said, "Yes, I always talk in ultimate dialogue." And he went, "Oh, nobody talks like that." Well, after about a week of this, I finally figured out to ask him, "Well, what's ultimate dialogue? What's the opposite?" And he said, "It's conventional dialogue." And I said, "Oh." So what I came to understand was that when we communicate always in conventional dialogue. The cat died, or I've got to go to the grocery store, or me and my husband got in a fight. So there's all these things about separation and mortality and all of these issues that we deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So as you start realizing that you are the source, you have to start changing your language, because then you go, well, there is no such thing as death. And if you come to the awareness that there is no death, that in fact you are immortal, that you will live forever, then you have to stop using that word. And if you're going to speak ultimate dialogue, you will never be able to use certain terms and words that you use when you want to speak in this state of consciousness. Now, the problem with that is that a lot of people don't want to stay in an ultimate state of consciousness all the time, or they need to be able to work things out at a conventional level. So they go, well, what about past lives? And when they ask about past lives, you have to say, okay, you were born, then you lived this life, then you died, then you went to the astral plane, then you were born again, then you lived a life, and then you died. But the problem with that is all of that is conventional knowledge. Even though it is a higher state of knowledge than someone who is completely unaware, it's still conventional, because everything abides within the mind of God, and there is no birth, there is no death. But conventionally, to be able to get to the state where you can abide in ultimate, you need to go through this conventional process first.
Sure. And it's not all bad.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, there's some really fun places in there. Well, let me ask you this, since we're on the subject of death, and suppose I'm having a conventional dialogue with you right now, from my end, someone dies, the people are conventionally sad, grieving around them. Do you have compassion for the ones that are in grief? Or because you have this perspective on death and that it doesn't exist, are you not bothered by their grief?
Well, the answer to that is very, very simple to me. Whether or not it can be understood or not, I don't know. When I see any sort of suffering or pain or sorrow or injustice or any of those conditional experiences that we associate with what you're describing there, I actually simultaneously abide in three states of awareness. The first state of awareness is absolutely no experience whatsoever. I'm in samadhi. I see everything as thought within my own mind as God. It is just an illusion. It is just a play. It is just a game that I'm experiencing. We, as God, manifest an infinite number of experiences and thoughts within our mind. And to be able to have those experiences, we have to place a veil before those manifestations of thought. Because if every single manifestation of the source knew that it was the source, it would not be able to experience. As you mentioned, you would just be in bliss going, hey, look, that's just God.
Mm-hmm.
So we place this veil before us, before this manifestation of thought within our mind, so that we can have these experiences. So what I see, what I perceive when these illusory actions occur, is that it is just thought within the mind of God. And so there's this pure bliss and this pure awareness of that. But at the same
time,
excuse me?
Oh, we've got a little background noise there. Please continue.
Okay. The other state is sort of a middle state. What I see is I see that manifestation, that conventional aspect of ourself, in that state of suffering. As you mentioned, say it's someone who is dealing with the grief from the death of a lost one. So I actually see that grief, I see that suffering, and I experience it, but I see it as this beautiful expression of God. I see it as this beautiful thing that the source itself wants to be able to experience. I even have one of my koans that says, God loves to cry. Because in the infinity model, we experience everything because we love that experience. So I see that as this beautiful manifestation, and you can look at it any way you want to. Is it a growing process? Is it something that they will learn down the road? Is it some old karma that they're working off? You can see it in an infinite number of conventional ideals. But it's just purely perfect. And then I also see the third state, where it's a conventional delusion, an illusory manifestation that is attached to all that pain, all that suffering, all that sorrow.
Right.
So I see and I perceive all three of those simultaneously, and I abide in those all.
I see. I like your answer. So it is about interpretation.
Yes.
Very nice. Now, I promised that we would talk a little bit about your journey to India and these holy presences that you encountered. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I've never been to India, and it says in your bio that you actually got to spend time with the Dalai Lama. Could you express a little bit about that?
Well, I got... I guess I've always just been very blessed. When I was working at the Healing Arts Center in Phoenix, Arizona, we were having very high teachers and lamas and mystics from all over the world come and do teachings at the center. And one time, and I never paid much attention to them, I wasn't really interested in titles or positions of power or higher states of consciousness or levels or any of that. I just enjoyed being with these people, and I enjoyed them being able to bring their knowledge to other people and share that with them. There was a monk that came through, and he did some very powerful empowerments. He was a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and I told him that I might at some point be interested in coming to India, and he said if I was, just to get a hold of him, and I could actually stay at his monastery. So a couple years passed. And the time came when there wasn't a desire to go there. I didn't need to go there to learn or to, because I was already fully established in this state. But there was just this flow. There was this, it's time to go there. And I had the money to be able to fly over there. I actually went with absolutely nothing but the money to be able to get there. I had about $200 when I arrived. As I mentioned, I had two pairs of pants and two shirts, and that was it. And when I got there, I found out that this simple little monk that I thought I was going to see happened to be a very, very high lama in the Tibetan Buddhism. And when I arrived, I ended up going to the Juto Monastery. It's a tantric monastery in northern Italy, just outside India, just outside of Dharamsala. And I stayed at this tantric monastery for 6 months in silence. And during that time, this monk, who actually ended up being a Tolku Rinpoche, and there are very few of them, and he happened to be the head of all the Tolkus. So he would probably be equivalent to about the third highest monk in Tibetan Buddhism under the Dalai Lama and then the leaders of the four branches. And because of his position, I was able to travel with him and meet the Dalai Lama. I think I was with the Dalai Lama over 21 times. I received almost every empowerment in Tibetan Buddhism from the Dalai Lama and other high monks, the Karmapa, the tantric monastery I was at, the Karmapa was actually living there, who was the head of the Kagyu order. And so it was really, really just amazing the opportunities I had. I received, as I mentioned, all of the empowerments from the secret tantric societies. After the 6 months, I then went down and stayed at the largest Tibetan monastery in India, the Drepung Lhasa Monastery. where again I stayed in silence for another year. I didn't go and talk to people. I would go out on the streets and walk. I would eat. Every day I had my own little room there at the monastery. So they would ring the bell at 5 o'clock, and I would go down and I would eat breakfast with the monks. I had my one little bowl, and they would fill it with rice and a little Tibetan tea. I would have my meal. I would go wash my bowl, and I would go back to my room or go for a walk. I would go to other monasteries. There were about 10 in that area, and I would just sit in silence and listen to their empowerments and their practices and their ceremonies. And so I spent another year doing this, just being in silence and just being a part of them. And really, to me, it was just being with old friends. It was being with my family again. And it was just really an amazing, beautiful experience.
That is incredible. And so when you were communicating with the Dalai Lama, did you discern that he had the ability to use this ultimate dialogue?
Yes, the teachings in Tibetan Buddhism, it's quite interesting because the place where I was, the monastery that I was in, and most of them that I visited, the Tibetan practice is that of a intellectual process. They literally study nothingness, emptiness. That is their highest teaching. And so they spend 20 years doing nothing but practicing emptiness, practicing nothingness, trying to understand and comprehend this very inexpressible and untouchable philosophy. So they're very learned in this. And so, yes, they were definitely able to be able to communicate and illustrate that very subtle understanding.
No doubt. So can you help us a little bit, because we have such a fascination with death as human beings. Can you help us to find better ways of expressing about this transition of our physicality? What words do you use?
I'm actually glad you asked that. I was afraid I was going to have to answer it with another answer, and then I would be giving everything away about eternity. So I don't really want to do that right now.
Okay, we're not going to do that right now.
I'd like to wait until I come and talk to your group there.
Thank you. That is so perfect, because, like I say, we can't resist. We have to go there, and so this is what everyone is searching for: is how do we balance this equation? We do pretty well until, you know, the big D, the death thing, comes up, and then we're like, yikes, I'm not sure about this. And
right.
You know, myself, I have been so conditioned to have certain reactions when someone dies, like, oh, yes. I'm so sorry. You know
right.
what? I mean, sometimes I'm not sorry, David.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because I'm just not.
Right.
And so it's a strange dance we're doing right now, because we're kind of partially in and partially out. And
mm-hmm.
I'm in such appreciation of you that you have very artfully invited everybody to come to your event at Nature's Treasures in Austin, Texas, to hear the Mystic Seven, where you are going to open up this whole realm of eternity for us on a Saturday afternoon and morning and afternoon, August the 2nd, from 9:30 in the morning to 5 p.m. There will be a lunch break, or you can brown bag it if you want to. And we are just going to have an absolutely phenomenal experience. And when you register online, this is so simple. you simply go to ntrocks.com. That's NT like Nature's Treasures, ntrocks.com, and you will be able to register online. And when you do that, you will be able to come to hear David Browning talk to us in ultimate dialogue, inviting us to be in nothingness, and it will only be at the cost of $49. Incredible, I know. Now, if you wait until the day of and you forget and you put it off and you just show up at the door, it's $77. So this is a very special, more than reasonable price in my estimation. And we're simply opening the door to Austin, Texas and the surrounding communities to come on in and make a new friend. And David Browning will be there not to be our teacher, because you can't teach this stuff. But this is a modeling. It is an experience for us. David, I grew up in a classical musician's home where my mother and father were violinists. And we grew up with this substance that we referred to for the to keep the hair of their bow, a healthy hair of their bow, and it and we called it rosin. So, talk to us. Is it resins? Is it rosins? I don't know. But these are rare, and you are going to be bringing this on that Saturday, August the 2nd. And tell us a little bit about the flavor of this. Do they create an aroma? Do you touch us with them? Do we see something? Tell us what that is.
Well, one of the things that I was determined to do when I found out that this could not be taught, and as you mentioned, I am not a teacher. There's absolutely no way that I can teach you eternity. But what I knew from the very beginning was that it was experiential. And if there was a way that I could find tools that I could acquire where people could drop into the actual experience, then I was very interested in that. And I found, in my own term, I use tantric as the term. And tantric for me is anything that you do using the senses to be able to make the mind go into a state of samadhi. And so anytime you can use a fragrance or a sight or a sound or a smell or touch to be able to make or to have the mind just drop and settle and go to that absolute silence, this is very effective. And so when I was running the Healing Arts Center in Phoenix, Arizona, we found and just basically stumbled across a book that was talking about different resins and herbs and aromas around the world. And so what we did, was very fortunate and had someone there had an unlimited budget, and we basically bought every fragrance known to man that was in this book. And not only did we buy every fragrance and every resin and every herb, we bought them from every manufacturer because we wanted to find out which ones were the best ones. And what I was able to do was I was able to find six specific resins and woods that are used to put us into a state of silence, or into a theta state is what the scientists call it. And so these resins, they work on a bunch of different ways. One of them is that everything that we smell, there's an association. So if you smell a rose, you think about the man that first, or the boy at this point, that gave you a rose for your prom. And you think about love and happiness and all those things that are associated with that rose. Well, the problem is that even though it's a beautiful association, the mind is still becoming active. It's thinking about the boy and how you felt and the prom and what you drove and what you wear and all these things, and the mind is not settling at all. So if you can find a fragrance that you've never smelled before, then there is no association with that. And when the mind perceives that fragrance, all it has is the pure experience, and there is no thought absolutely to it except the experience itself. And the mind drops, it becomes settled, and it goes into silence. So with these fragrances, not only are they fragrances that you've never smelled before, but they're also fragrances that are used specifically for putting the mind into a theta state to actually use for meditation. And some of them are fragrances that have been used by the ancient oracles of Greece. They've been used by shamans 5,000-10,000 years ago. And so their purpose is to actually do this. And so when we burn these fragrances, these resins, we are able to go into a very, very deep state of samadhi. And I've been able to do this with people who are drinking, who are smoking, who are doing drugs. And when we burn these fragrances, they are able to drop into the state of samadhi. And when I see that it can do that to them, I knew that it could do it to anybody. And I've used this over and over and over again. And every time, again, without exception, people are able to go into a state of silence.
That is just extraordinary. I wanted to ask you about a particular word, and I want to get your take on this particular word because it crops up occasionally, and that's the word esoteric. Is what you are sharing with us tonight esoteric knowledge that has been withheld from us, perhaps, or is it not possible to hold or withhold this information?
Well, I'm a little embarrassed, and I have to be completely honest with you. As I mentioned, I have read very little on this subject. The reason is because when I was going through this process, I wanted to make sure, since I knew nothing about metaphysics and nothing about Buddhism, Hinduism, and Eastern philosophy, mm-hmm. I knew that all the information that was coming from within me. And I wanted to make sure that in no way was I corrupting that information. So I knew that if I went out and read a book by Thich Nhat Hanh or some other spiritual teacher, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, that it was possible for me to go into a state of samadhi later. And when I came out, I would have this awareness, and then I would not be able to tell, was this something that I had read in that book, or was it something that was from within?
Yeah.
So I got in the habit to never read anything during that two-year period that I mentioned earlier about when I was just sort of looking to see if I had lost my mind or not. All I would do was open up a book, and in that book there would be that exact verbatim, word for word, what I had written, and I went, okay, you know, this is what Gandhi said. I feel okay with that, and I would close the book. So the word esoteric, I would not even know what the definition of that is. But I can answer your question about whether this can be withheld or not. I am not special. I am not some unusual circumstance or special being that has acquired all of this merit and now has been given this blessing from something outside of ourselves. This is within every single one of us. Every single person, every single being, every single entity has this within them, so it cannot be held from them because it is their very nature.
Oh, that's a beautiful, beautiful answer. You know, in the past, when avatars have been on the earth and people notice that there is something intrinsically empowered, They are in their knowingness, and they have access to realms that others don't. There is a tendency to lift them up and worship them.
Yes.
And you are not bashful about saying that this is your life experience, and you are living these keys, that you are abiding in this particular awareness, do you find that people want to try to make themselves separate from you by adoring you and worshiping you?
Yes, I do. And to be completely honest, it was one of my determining factors to stay in the cave for so long, was because I knew I had traveled around for several years and saw all the gurus on the planet. I saw the Dalai Lama. I saw Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. I saw Gangaji, Eckhart Tolle, every single teacher. And without fail, and spent time with them, extended periods of time, not just went and visited once. And without fail, every single group that was around these teachers did exactly what you said. They worshiped their teacher.
Yeah.
And I knew that if people looked towards me, they would never look within.
Yep.
And I said, I'm not going to do that. I will never put myself in a position where people will look at me. So when I finally did come out of the cave and decided I was going to do this process, which wasn't the Mystic Seven group at all, I was just planning on finishing my second book, and I was getting a group of people together which would force me to compile my data and do the book. Since then, the groups have taken off, and it's just really very beautiful. But I, every single day that I am in front of people, remind them that I am not special, that I do not know something that I do not know, that they do not know. In fact, I remind them quite regularly, the Mystic Seven group that we have in Tyler, that we are not separate, and that in fact all I am is simply a thought within their own mind. That they are simply teaching themselves, and that there is this appearance that there is separation, but that I am truly within them, that I am not separate from them. And my only job that I can do is to keep reminding them this, that there is not something outside of them that is teaching, that it is them. It is their awareness. It is their knowledge.
If there's anyone on the call right now, just speak up. If you have a question for David Browning, just go ahead and speak up, and we'll receive you.
Hi, David. I'm Gail, and I'm sorry I'm late, but at least I'm getting to hear a little bit of what you're saying. I don't even know enough to ask a question, so if you could brief me a little bit, I might come up with one.
We're talking about the Mystic Seven, and hi, Gail, and I mean, this is deep. So, David, give her a tiny little overview. That's good to re-encapsulate here.
Well, what I would like to do is I'd like to go ahead and go back, since we have the opportunity, to a question that you asked about death.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really, really strong driving force in our life. And whereas I don't want to go into the total answer, because like I said, we'll do that when we do the Mystic Seven here in Austin, I would like to touch base on what manifestation is.
Nice.
The three foundation principles that I introduce before we do the Mystic Seven groups is, the first one is, there is a source. And that's very, very simple. It's, you know, people believe that there is an energy, a nature, a force that exists. And they give it all sorts of names. They call it Brahman or Yahweh, Buddha, Allah, God. Others refer to it as our higher power or the self or consciousness. But whatever name we give it, we all agree that there's this force. There's this thing that's outside of us that's greater than us. So there is this source. That's number one. Number two, it is self-aware. And this is self-evident because we are the source and we are aware. We perceive everything, unfortunately, as delusional as we do outside of ourselves, which it's not. But we do perceive, and therefore we have consciousness. We have thought. And then the third one is manifestation. And this is the big stumbling block for everybody. And that is because everybody believes that manifestation is something outside of themselves, that manifestation is something outside of God, that is something outside of the source. And actually, there are within the source no dimensions of time and space. There are no physical, ethereal, or spiritual realities at all. Everything in the perceivable and non-perceivable universe is simply an infinite collection of thought and experiences that are abiding within the mind of God. An infinite collection of thought and experiences that are abiding within our own mind. And what create these illusory realities are the varying states of consciousness that we as the source are currently abiding in. And so what I use are states of consciousness. You as the source at this moment are in a state of consciousness where you believe you are either conducting, participating, or listening to a radio show. This is the state of consciousness that you as the source are currently abiding in, that you are perceiving. But you are also abiding and perceiving an infinite number of experiences and realities. It's just the one that you are currently perceiving.
Sure.
And so what happens is we shift from state to state to state. And so when you go from a state of consciousness and a delusional state of consciousness where you've placed the veil before yourself so that you can have experience of pain and suffering, love and joy, and everything else, what you do is you then shift from that state of consciousness into a state of consciousness where you believe you're sick. And then you shift to a state of consciousness where you believe you have died and are in the astral plane. And then you shift to a state of consciousness where you are being reborn or reincarnated and you believe that there is a birth. But these aren't actually happening. These are just illusory thoughts within your own mind. These are just shifting states of consciousness.
Yes, okay.
Is that when we're identified with the source of all and everything?
Excuse me, what was the question?
Is it just an illusion when we're identified with all and everything, and when we are identified with these little separate individual packages, that seems incomprehensible because of the limitations of the physical capacities?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're really getting somewhere there.
The delusions that we're all having, that we're separate and we each have these individual bodies that we can't see past unless we're identified with the whole source, is it possible for the individual packages to help one another dispel delusions?
That's a very good question.
I think it's a good question, too.
That is a very good question.
I keep begging for that help. And,
yes.
But I'm not sure if I'm asking for something that's realistic.
To answer the last part of the question, do we have a responsibility? It's very, very tricky. It gets into actually the sixth of the mystic seven, which is neither affirmation nor negation, because the answer is both yes and no.
Okay.
The answer is no, we do not have responsibility, because basically everything is the source. And so it is abiding in its perfect state of consciousness at any given point. Now, the opposite of that, neither negation nor affirmation, is that because one of the beautiful manifestations of the source is simply another game which we call enlightenment, which is no different than being a trash collector or a paramedic or a doctor or a teacher, it is simply another game that we of the source have decided to play, then it is our responsibility that those that come before us, if we have the skill and if we have the knowledge and if we have the compassion to guide them, not to teach them, but to guide them to their own inner self, then yes, we do have that responsibility. But again, remember, it's a yes and a no answer.
And how do we know we're not projecting our delusion onto them in our assumption of being a guide?
Being a guide?
Yeah.
I think that would be, it probably isn't known to most people because I have watched many, many, many teachers. And most teachers think that they are right. Most teachers think that the path they are on is the true path to the divine and the true path to the source.
I know that in my own coaching, my Waking Up to Me coaching, the tendency, the temptation to just give them the answer, you know, to just say, why don't you just do this, you know, maybe you'll mm-hmm. have a great life. The temptation is very great, but that's not where the greatest source of joy is for me. It's for them to discover for themselves, and then I also get to make new discoveries. So I really, really like your answer. Gail, thank you so much for your participation. I love you. Thank you so much. David, I wanted to ask, how can we get your book? Tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, it actually comes in three different versions. The first version is a black and white text only, a soft cover. I also have a black and white text-only hardcover. And the third version is a full color, 8x10. It's sort of like a coffee table, modern Tao Te Ching. It's full of koans and sutras, poetry and salsongs. And they're on individual pages rather than the black and white where there's just dozens of them on each page. Each individual page has its own sutra, its own koan, and a beautiful, beautiful illustration that helps support that knowledge that's associated with that and help with the contemplation. All three of those books, you can contact us on my website at www.retreattosilence.com. And that's the number two. So it's RETREAT, number two, and then silence.com. And you can buy the book there. You can contact us, and you can get the book. It's currently, we are just doing print on demand, so the price is a little bit high, but it's still definitely worth it. We're hoping to be able to get this published within the next 6 months and get the prices down. But they're beautiful books, and you would definitely spend the rest of your life studying the material in there.
Well, I can attest to that because I've had the pleasure of leafing through it. The name of the book is Seeing Through the Eyes of God, and the book is incredibly impactful. The magnitude of the presence of this book and the words on the pages and the accompanying images are just breathtaking. And so I wish that all of you could just hold it and look at it right this very minute because it is spectacular. It's grandest version, it's like a coffee table book, and so those are not as affordable as some of the smaller versions. But it's like, I don't know, over $100 for your coffee table book. But the very same information, the same quality is in the other versions. So please investigate that and go to, let's see, you said it was Silent Retreat.
Retreat to Silence.
Retreat 2, with the numeral 2, retreat2silence.com, and you'll be able to get it there. I promised everyone that we would also just really go into the description of your incredible Samadhi Retreat and Meditation Center. Tell us a little bit about that, because we've got a little bit more time, if you can hang on for about 5 more minutes.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. This is out in East Texas. I have been there, and I had an absolutely superb time at the grand opening. And, yeah, tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, this was one of those beautiful things that just manifest itself. As I mentioned, my full, without having intent, was to write the second book. I had some information that I thought people would really enjoy. It was some really beautiful information that I had for the last 17 years. And what I was doing was putting together a group where it would force me to write the Mystic Seven. And what happened was I met a lady who you mentioned earlier by the name of Dawn Breeze at the Unity Church in Pilar. And I told her about what I wanted to do. And she said, well, I have a group and we would love to have you come talk to us.
Uh-oh,
so I went, I know it. I went and spoke with her group, and they just loved the information, and they said, we want to do this every week. And so we started meeting every week, and I said, good, this is what I need to do. And so 1 week I would compile information on eternity, and I would share it with them, and then the next week I'd compile information on infinity. And so I was getting all my information from all my writings in the right place to be able to do the book. But what happened was the groups were getting so popular that I was having more fun with the groups and wasn't doing anything on the book, which was fine with me because really, ultimately, I don't mind what I'm doing. I just love being able to see people have this experience, to be able to drop into samadhi and to be able to see the truth that's within them. So after about a month, my father was thinking about moving out of his house. He has this huge 4,000 square foot ranch house out in East Texas, and he was going to sell it and move into a little trailer on my other brother's ranch, on his ranch. And Don and I started talking and said, well, why don't we turn this into a spiritual center? We got together, and I think it probably wasn't more than a couple of days. We decided that she was going to move onto the property. We started redesigning and remodeling the entire second floor into a meditation center, and I don't remember the timeline. It was just a whirlwind thing, and to be honest, I don't know much about time anymore, but within a very short period of time, we had a meditation center and the grand opening. It has a huge 1,500 square foot great room that we use. It holds 30 people with hardwood floors for meditation. We have two or three rooms where people can stay. We have another small meditation room. It's on 64 acres of beautiful ranch land with wooded acreage, a 7-acre lake. And we just held our first silent retreat last weekend, I believe it was. We had 10 people. We kept it very small because it was the first event that we held there. 10 people came, stayed in silence. We worked on the first principle of the Mystic Seven, which is the source. And everybody had an amazing time. They're all coming back for the next silent retreat on September 13th and bringing their friends. This time we're going to accept 20 people. And it's just a beautiful facility. And Don and I are having an amazing time out there.
And if people want to find out more about that, they can go to retreat2silence.com. And I see here that you have payment options available, so you can maybe put some money down and hold your reservation and then pay the balance later on. So
absolutely,
you're going to have, yeah, your next retreat will be September 12th through the 15th. That's a Monday through Monday, Friday, 6 o'clock. I take it that's p.m. Friday,
that's correct.
6 o'clock p.m. through Monday at 3 o'clock p.m. September 12th through 15th. That is fantastic. And I also wanted to make sure that that you've got some new friends on your Facebook. If you want to go to David Browning's Facebook page, that is Samadhi, that's S as in Sam, S-A-M-A-D-H-I, Samadhi Retreat and Meditation Center. And I'm sure that that you'd like to follow and find out what they're doing out there in East Texas and all over the place as they take samadhi, as they enjoy samadhi as they go. David, this has just been so much fun. I have just loved every minute of it, and I am looking so forward to being with you when you're in Austin and your Mystic 7 presentation. It's not your typical workshop. It
no.
is an experience. And we're going to do we're going to get involved with these rare resins, and you're going to introduce these mantras and varying states of consciousness, and like
yeah.
you promised, eternity.
Yes.
So that's really something to wait for, and it will be Saturday, August 2nd, 2014, and you can register online, and I would recommend that you do register online. It will be at Nature's Treasures of Texas here in Austin at 4103 North IH-35. The way you register, for $49, that is the online registration, it'll be $77 at the door. So register online, and that is ntrocks.com, ntrocks.com, and you'll be able to register for the Mystic 7 and meet David Browning in person. David, have we covered everything except eternity?
Maybe not everything, but we've covered a lot.
we really have, and it's just been so wonderful. So I want to just give you the last moments to allow people to hear your heart about what you know in your knowingness about what they will receive when they come to the Mystic 7.
The driving force, the most important thing to me, is that people are able to actually have this experience. I don't want an atmosphere where people are being talked to or they're being told that they can do certain practices and have certain outcomes that aren't anything but the ultimate truth that lies within them. And so everything that I do, every practice that I teach, every word that I speak, is so that people can go into that state of silence and have this experience and become aware that all of this abides within them.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, my friend, we really are doing this, and I'm looking forward to being with you. I do want to just bring out a couple of things that I'm reading on the chat here. We had referred to David Browning's book, Seeing Through the Eyes of God. It is also available through the on your computer, and it's a PDF version, and you can go to the website retreat2silence.com. That's the numeral 2, retreat2silence.com. That's $25. So if you can't swing the big coffee table, big humongous thing, then $25 will get you that PDF download. And the Facebook is facebook.com/samadhi retreat. Well, that's it, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me on Unzipping Reality, The Third Awakening. I'm Leah LaChapelle, and oneness happens. It's the great letting go with allowance and balance. So trust the process. Know the process, be the process, and do the process. Bye-bye, everyone.